Welcome to Explorations in Music, a production of KALW in cooperation with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This season, a triangle for the ages. Today, Clara carries on in spite of everything.
No wonder Clara wore black for the rest of her life. She never stopped mourning her dead. Proud, dignified, forced to bear inconceivable pain throughout her adult life, suffering in her last years from debilitating joint and shoulder problems that forced her to retire from the stage, photos of the elderly Clara reveal a face and a spirit well described by the cliché, battered but unbowed.
Dr. Robert Greenberg holds a Ph.D. in music composition from the University of California at Berkeley, and since 1989 has been San Francisco Performance's music historian in residence. He has performed, taught, and lectured extensively in North America and Europe. The Alexander String Quartet is among the world's premier ensembles, maintaining a busy international touring and teaching schedule and recording for their own label, Foghorn Classics. While there's no doubt that Brahms and Clara were very close and loved each other, it was Clara who suffered the most from this triangle. Now here's Dr. Robert Greenberg.
Here's an understatement for us. Clara's life after Robert was not easy. Oh my goodness, next time we're feeling sorry for ourselves or contemplating our stress or our issues, I'm going to want you to reflect on Clara Schumann's life after the death of her husband, and indeed before the death of her husband, because she had a tough path, and it's time to talk about it. Money, well, money was a constant issue. As the sole breadwinner for a family of eight, she had to concertize constantly in order to make ends meet. She was deeply conflicted about her profession versus her duties as a mother, and the guilt she felt leaving her children for long periods of time with nannies and babysitters took both a heavy psychological and a heavy physical toll on her. Clara's kids, oh my goodness, Clara's kids were an ongoing source of misery for her. Her son Emile, born in 1856, died after 16 months. Ludwig, born in 1848, manifested symptoms of mental illness from a very young age. At the age of 22, he was diagnosed as having an incurable spinal disease that presumably affected his brain. Clara wrote in her diary, "I have not felt such pain since the misfortune with Robert. The nights were often dreadful. For hours I would see the poor boy before me, looking at me with his good, honest eyes." Clara, on the advice of doctors, had Ludwig committed to an asylum in 1871. She visited him there twice, only twice, once in 1875 and once again in 1876. He begged her to take him home, but it was too much for her, and she simply couldn't face her son. And she never saw him again, even though she lived another 20 years. Clara had a son named Ferdinand. He was born in 1849. He became a morphine addict and predeceased her by 5 years, dying at the age of 42. Felix, born in 1854, after Robert's hospitalization, at a time when Brahms had already come in and helped take over the household, Felix, the youngest of the children and everyone's favorite, died of tuberculosis at the age of 24, predeceasing his mother by almost 18 years. Clara's daughter, Julie, born in 1845, was a radiant beauty. The pictures of her are stunning. Michelle Pfeiffer comes to mind when I think of what she looked like. But she was also a woman of delicate health, and she died of tuberculosis at the age of 27, predeceasing her mother by 24 years. When I said Clara had a rotten life, I wasn't kidding. No wonder Clara wore black for the rest of her life. She never stopped mourning her dead. Proud, dignified, forced to bear inconceivable pain throughout her adult life, suffering in her last years from debilitating joint and shoulder problems that forced her to retire from the stage, photos of the elderly Clara reveal a face and a spirit well described by the cliché, battered but unbowed. Piano Quintet by Brahms in F minor, Opus 34. Now, Brahms began Opus 34 in 1862, and it first came to life as a string quintet scored for two violins, a viola, and two cellos. Without any doubt, Brahms's inspiration for his two-cello quintet was Franz Schubert's magisterial two-cello string quintet in C major, which Schubert had written back in 1828. In 1862, Brahms sent the newly completed score of this string quintet to his buddy, Joseph Joachim, in Hanover, the same Joachim who, 9 years before, had been responsible for introducing Brahms to Robert and Clara Schumann. Now, ever the helpy Helperton, Joachim arranged for a performance of the quintet, after which he managed to convince Brahms that the power and the range of the music could not possibly be expressed by just strings. So Brahms went back to the drawing board. Joachim was one of the very few people in the world whose judgment he trusted enough to alter a piece of music based on that judgment. Brahms went back to the drawing board and rescored the piece for two pianos. Now that version, by the way, is known today as Brahms's Sonata in F minor for two pianos, Opus 34B. But this two-piano version didn't cut the mustard, or rather the cheese, either. So, this time it was Clara who, after performing the piece with Brahms, offered up her two pfennigs. She believed that only an orchestra could do the piece justice, she wrote to Brahms. It is interesting throughout, masterly from every point of view, but it is a work whose ideas you must scatter over an entire orchestra. Please, please, dear Johannes, for this once, take my advice and recast it as an orchestral work, unquote. Well, you know what? No such luck, Clara. Johannes Brahms was not going to be baited into writing an orchestral work. Robert's curse, the article, was still at work. Instead, during the summer and fall of 1864, Brahms produced the version of the piece that we know today as a quintet for piano and strings. Oh, by the way, if we'd like to hear the original string quintet version of the piece, we are out of luck. It was among the hundreds of unpublished manuscripts Brahms consigned to his kitchen stove near the end of his life. Dude. If big was the operative word for the piano quartet in G minor, then the key word for the piano quintet is bigger. Bigger sound, bigger expressive content, and an even greater intensity of developmental variation than Opus 25. So big is the expressive impact of the quintet that it has been called a virtual piano concerto. But in fact, it's bigger than that. Because Brahms doesn't treat the pianist as merely a soloist, but rather as virtually a second, fully interactive, fully reinforcing ensemble. For example, let's hear the unrelenting, even savage opening, the A section, of the third movement scherzo. Thank you. Big music, yes. Movement one, sonata form. Let's hear the themes, always keeping in mind that Brahms's apparently contrasting themes are carefully designed outgrowths of one another. Theme one begins with a pensive melody that we will acknowledge right up front sounds rather like the Fairbrass Brothers' 1991 hit, Too Sexy for My Shirt, So Sexy That It Hurts, and so forth. That's why I only do one show a day, okay? Theme two is a long, sprawling theme group, reminiscent of the second theme of the first movement of the G minor piano quartet. Here is theme two of this quintet. The second movement has been described as having the melodic lilt of a Schubert song and the rhythmic zip of a Johann Strauss Jr. waltz. You know, it comes as a surprise to many people that the prickly, pathologically critical Johannes Brahms was a great fan and an even greater friend of Johann Strauss Jr., the composer of the beautiful Blue Danube Waltz and the operetta Die Fledermaus, the bat. Here is the opening of Brahms' second movement, music that, for a change, actually sounds like chamber music. We'll have an intimacy here that that we've not experienced thus far. We've already heard a big chunk of the third movement. Let's move forward directly to the fourth movement. Movement four. All right, following an initially mysterious and eventually ringing introduction, the following theme, what we will simply call for our purposes now, theme A, emerges in the cello. Well, excuse us if we're just a tad bit underwhelmed. This theme sounds to my ear more like Frère Jacques, nothing personal, Sandy. Are you sleeping? Are you sleeping, Brother John? Yo, Brother John! Sounds more like a nursery rhyme song than the principal theme for a big quintet finale. But this movement is not so much about its themes, but about what they become over the course of the movement. Let's hear this opening theme in its entirety, and let us be amazed by how it grows and develops before our very ears. The passage that follows, which we will simply call theme B, also begins simply like theme A, but quickly grows and develops into music of extraordinary power and force. Let's hear this theme B. So this fourth movement is not about fully developed, or should we say fully formed themes being presented at its beginning and then developed. Rather, it's about very simple thematic entities being transformed over its course and thus becoming ever more dramatic, ever more forceful. Indeed, the music that follows, theme A, is now completely transformed. Let's hear that version of theme A. Thank you. Eventually, theme B will return to be newly developed as well. Theme A then returns again, transformed once again, this time into a blazing version in 6/8 or compound duple meter. Here's how that blazing version of theme A begins. Now, I would tell you the finish line is still about 90 seconds away, during which elements of both themes will be freely combined. A brief fugue is going to bust forth, and the movement and the quintet with it will reach its fittingly explosive conclusion. My friends, it's all very big. Clara and Johannes at the end. It was in the early 1890s that Brahms, approaching now his 60th birthday, became concerned, terrified, would not be too strong a word, that future generations were going to know more about him than he wanted them to know. So he began to recall from his friends the hundreds, the thousands of letters he had written to them over the years. In no case was this recall more gut-wrenching than it was for Clara, who knew that Brahms intended to destroy his letters. She begged him to let her save a few of them, but he adamantly refused. Ultimately, she returned them all, and this unique correspondence, a veritable four-decade eyewitness history of Europe and European music, was consigned to the flames. Just like that. Destroy the evidence, though he did, we know that Johannes Brahms loved Clara. For all their ups and downs, they rarely went more than a few weeks without seeing each other. Brahms was a surrogate father to Clara's children. He even fell in love with one of them, Clara's daughter, Julie, the one I compared to Michelle Pfeiffer. But Brahms could never and would never declare his love for Julie. First, because it would have utterly destroyed Clara. And second, because in Brahms' mind, it would have been tantamount to incest. Woody Allen, he was not. Brahms suffered deeply from the illnesses and deaths of Clara's children. In particular, Felix Schumann's wasting away from tuberculosis utterly broke his heart. In 1874, in response to Felix's declining health, Brahms wrote to Clara, quote, "I feel your pain and anxiety much too deeply to be able to express it to you in words. Let this deep love of mine be a comfort to you, for I love you more than I love myself, and more than anybody or anything on this earth." Now, moments of revelatory honesty like that aside, Clara, God bless her, never figured Johannes out. On May 7th, 1880, Clara played Brahms's then brand new Opus 79 Rhapsodies for piano solo for a house full of guests who included Brahms and a young man named Max Kalbeck, who would become Brahms's first biographer. Well, Johannes was in one of his black, foul, nasty moods. Clara asked Kalbeck what Brahms was so upset about. Kalbeck said he hadn't the faintest idea. According to Kalbeck, Clara's eyes suddenly filled with tears, and she told him, quote, "Would you believe that in spite of our long and intimate friendship, Johannes has never told me anything about what excites or upsets him? He is just as much of a riddle, I could almost say as much of a stranger, as he was to me 25 years ago, unquote. Call their 43-year relationship whatever we will, it was the one true emotional anchor in Brahms's life. For all Clara's suffering, her moaning and sniffling and sobbing, and flashes of white-hot anger at Brahms's not infrequent and titanic insensitivity, Brahms could not live in a world without her, and he knew that to be true. The news came by telegram on May 20th, 1896, from Clara's eldest daughter, Marie. Our mother fell gently asleep today. Clara had suffered a devastating stroke on May 16th. She lingered for 4 days, and then she died. Brahms was physically incapable of taking part in the funeral procession. He hid behind some large funeral wreaths and sobbed uncontrollably. He told the violinist Alwin von Beckeroff, "Now I have nobody left to lose." Returning from Clara's funeral, Brahms looked unwell, strained, shrunken, predisposed to weep. He wrote it off to his grief, but a yellowish cast to his eyes and his skin finally forced Brahms to do the thing he hated most in the world, and that is visit a doctor in July of 1896. He was diagnosed with jaundice and prescribed a strict diet. Now putting Brahms on a diet was like telling a hyena not to gnaw on bone. Brahms, who had hardly been sick a single day in his life, jokingly described his illness as my petit bourgeois jaundice. But of course it wasn't jaundice, it was cancer of the liver, the same disease that had killed his father. Brahms was not told he was dying, but by the fall, by October 1896, he knew. He joked about his weight loss, saying that he had traded his round Romanesque body for a pointed Gothic one. He studied Bach scores during the day and continued to go out with his buds at night. Everyone went along with the charade that there was nothing wrong with Johannes. But there was, and Brahms died slowly. He had lots of time to burn his remaining letters, his papers, his sketchbooks, and all of his remaining unpublished manuscripts. The end came for him just before 9 a.m. on April 3rd, 1897, 10 months after Clara's death. Brahms's long-term housekeeper, Celestine Truxa, who Brahms referred to as his permanent police escort, had walked into the room. He tried to sit up and say something, but he could not. Frau Truxa remembered. Great tears rolled down his face, and he fell on the pillow. Then, with no struggle at all, he stopped breathing. Gwendolyn Mock and the Alexander String Quartet performed Brahms's Quintet for Piano and Strings in F minor, Opus 34 of 1864. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Explorations in Music on KALW. Today's program featured Brahms' Piano Quintet in F minor, Opus 34. We hope you enjoyed our 14th season, A Triangle for the Ages. Thanks for listening. Explorations in Music is produced for KALW by Eric Wayne in association with San Francisco Performances, the Alexander String Quartet, and Dr. Robert Greenberg. For more information about San Francisco Performances and their upcoming events, visit them on the web at sfperformances.org. The Alexander String Quartet are violinists Zacharias Grafilo and Frederick Lifsitz, violist Paul Yarbrough, and cellist Sandy Wilson. You can find out more and purchase recordings of the ASQ on their website, asq4.com. The lecturer was Dr. Robert Greenberg, music historian in residence at San Francisco Performances. The concerts were recorded at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. You can join us on Facebook by searching for Explorations in Music. Our email address is explorations@kalw.org. Thanks for listening. I'm David LaTulipe.